It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. On today's show, we're checking in with the outdoor community here in South Central Alaska, which is all about getting ready for the coming winter and being involved in the positive stuff so many of our neighbors are doing for one another. For our first segment, we'll have an update on the Klutna River. An old dam that had held back the river for many decades is finally gone. Now the issue is getting water back in the river for fish. Water now being used for power and for Anchorage residents to drink. After that, we have a tech talk for cross-country skiers, both the beginners and the experts, about how to prepare your skis for the winter. It doesn't have to be complicated, but it can make skiing more fun to have fast skis, and that's something that takes a little work. And finally, I have a couple of guests who are doing some inspiring work, which you can help out with. They've both traveled to Guatemala and have seen how girls there have to give up an active life because they don't have the basics that American women take for granted, sports bras and menstruation supplies. And these Anchorage women are trying to fix that. It's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer. Well, my first guest today is someone who's been with me before talking about a couple of different things. Brad Micklejohn is with the Conservation Fund, and he is responsible for kind of an amazing project. It's the kind of thing that you usually hear about taking forever, decades, and lots of controversy, which is the removal of a dam. Klutna River was dammed many decades ago. Water was held back for power production. Then the dam was stopped being used, but it still sat there blocking the river. Brad went out and raised the money to actually remove the dam. And here's the amazing part. The dam's gone. And problem is, the water's not back. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Brad, thanks for being with us again.
Charles, great to be here. Thanks for your ongoing interest in this story.
Yeah, I think the last time you were here, the dam was still being removed. And now it's completely gone. And what does it take to remove a dam? I mean, that sounds like a huge project.
Yeah, as you pointed out, most of these big dam removals do take decades. The ones that came down on the Elwha River in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington literally took 30 years to come down. And when I first started looking at this project, I thought there had to be a better way. And I set out to find it. And I think the key for us in this was using private money to get the job done. A lot of these big dam removals across the country have taken federal funds and other public funds that often have long lead times and are difficult to cobble together. So we took a different path and brought all private money to bear, and I think that made a huge difference because it wasn't controversial in terms of the politics. We weren't having to go through long appropriation cycles. And we didn't have any specific restrictions on the use of the fund, so we could move much more fleetly. And I give a big tip of the hat to the folks at Klutna. Using them as our contractor to take the dam down was the most brilliant decision that we made. And it's been a real pleasure to work with the people of Klutna. They are some of the most gracious and humble folks on the planet. And
the Klutna Village Corporation?
Yeah, the Klutna Village Corporation is, in fact, the largest landowner in Anchorage. They own some 96,000 acres of land.
Wow.
The way they put it, Klutna is not in Anchorage. Anchorage is in Klutna. All of this area used to be their territory, and now they're reduced down to a much smaller footprint than the area that they used to roam around and fish in and hunt in and subsist in. And so I think we all owe a collective debt of gratitude to the Dena'ina Klutna people. And there's some wonderful folks over there. A special note to Curtis McQueen, the CEO, is doing a masterful job of threading that balance point between development and conservation. And it's been a supreme joy for me to work with those folks. And they have a subsidiary, Klutna Construction and Management, that ended up being the contractor to take the dam down. And that was a singular stroke of luck that we stumbled on them.
And that's a big, I mean, we're talking about a heavy construction job. I mean, this is way up in the mountains and using a lot of heavy equipment to essentially smash concrete, right?
Yeah, if you drove the Glen Highway in the last couple of years, you probably saw this large yellow crane sticking up above the skyline. And when I first saw that, I thought, well, we better alert the FAA because there are a lot of small planes flying along that hillside. That was the largest crane in Alaska, 400-foot tall boom And we had it on site for 2 years, and its job was to put the equipment into the canyon that was being used to demolish the dam. And that was an instrumental piece of the job. Without that crane, we couldn't have accessed the site. It's down, the dam was down in a 400-foot deep canyon. And the crane operators had their hands full working at that job site because, as the crane operator said, cranes do tip over. And he said, Google crane tip overs. Most of them happen in Russia. Fortunately, it didn't happen here, but the crane was slinging, you know, D6s and D9s down into the canyon.
Incredible.
It's quite a sight to see.
Yeah, really.
So it was a pretty cool project. At the very end, we did demolish the dam. Principally through kind of a jackhammer method, but at the end we took the last bit out with explosives. It was getting to be a pretty dangerous work site with a lot of sediment that had backfilled in the dam, sort of acting in an unstable fashion and threatening the workers. So we took the last little bit of the concrete out in August with an explosive blast, and that was exciting in and of itself.
That must have been really something to see.
Yeah, we have some great drone footage from that, yeah. And excitingly, Ryan Peterson, a great filmmaker from here in Alaska, is putting together a movie funded by Patagonia on the project, and that should be out early winter. So we're hoping to show that around to some of the film festivals and, of course, here at the Beartooth.
Yeah, and Patagonia and all these other outdoor sort of oriented outfits were involved in contributing to this, right?
I mean,
this
was
a private thing where, of contributions, which is probably one reason why it went a lot faster is private land, private money, right?
Exactly right.
But, I mean, now they get to come in and take some pride in this.
And there's a lot of pride. We had, I don't know how many different donors, probably a dozen major donors and mm-hmm. hundreds of smaller donors. And everyone's got a kind of a piece of ownership in this. And we had a celebration in late September up at the lake. We had 165 people come out to form a bucket brigade to move water from the lake into the river symbolically. And I think it was a great kind of, it was a way for folks to feel involved. And one of the pieces that I think has been compelling about this project is we're fixing something. We're kind of putting Humpty Dumpty back on the wall.
Right.
And there's a restorative quality to that I think is really healing for people. It's been mm-hmm. exciting to be part of that and see how it really sparks people's mm-hmm. interest.
Now, it's a fairly remote spot, not all that easy to get to, but if we went there, we would see still kind of a shelf of sediment there, right? Because there hasn't been enough water to actually clean it out yet.
Yeah, the sediment is starting to move downstream, but there's a lot of material that built up in the period since the dam was abandoned in the mid-1950s. We had roughly 300,000 cubic yards of sand and gravel and silt that built up behind that dam once it was abandoned. Some of that material is starting to work its way downstream to the benefit of fish. The downstream channel was starved of sediment and basically down to bare rock and not very conducive to spawning fish. But there's still a lot of that material that's on site upstream of the dam that's slowly eroding. But as you pointed out, we've done the first part of the restoration effort by taking the dam out. But right now, there's very little water running in that channel, principally because of diversions for hydropower production and drinking water. And without more water flushing through that river, that sediment's going to take a long time to erode out. And that's a concern that we have. If that sediment stays in place for the next few years, it will start to vegetate with alders and willows and probably create kind of a slumping, ongoing, messy situation that's not very attractive
Could
for
fish.
Could
turn into sort of a land function, yeah.
And so getting more water restored to that channel sooner rather than later is going to be hugely important to start flushing that sediment out and improving conditions. If this goes on for 4 or 5 years, it's not going to be a very attractive situation for the fish. And it's important to point out that the salmon are still in the river, despite the fact that the Eklutna is just a pale fraction of its former self. There are still 5 species of salmon in the Eklutna, including roughly 200 king salmon that came back in 2018. So the fish are still there, amazingly, after all these years.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm talking with Brad Mickeljohn, who's with the Conservation Fund. And Brad led this amazing project you've just heard about to take out the dam on the Eklutna River, a salmon stream that was blocked by a dam for, 89 years. Now is open, but it's still lacking water. And so it's still, the job isn't done. My name is Charles Wolforth. So, Brad, just to understand this, so this dam was not used because the river was sort of rerouted into a tunnel up from Elkutna Lake, right? And that tunnel produced electricity and has, I guess, since the 1950s or for many years. And then there's another tunnel that's taking water out to drink.
Let me draw you a little bit of a visual map. The dam that we just removed was built in 1929 by a guy named Frank Reed, one of the early Anchorage mm-hmm. boosters. It operated as Anchorage's first major power supply until the early 1950s. It was a relatively small facility. I think the total power production was something on the order of 2 or 3 megawatts, not a lot of power, but it was a first major power supply for Anchorage. Power ran by wire into Anchorage. It was supplanted and basically rendered obsolete in the mid-1950s when a federal power project went online up at Elkutna Lake. And that project involved the construction of a tunnel through Twin Peaks, a 4.5-mile tunnel that took the water from Elkutna Lake over to a power plant on the Kinnick River on the Old Glenn Highway. So that's where 90% of the water in the Elkutna Basin goes to produce power at that power plant. Another 10% runs by pipeline down the Elkutna River Valley to a water treatment plant there near our the dam site. And then by gravity feed on into Anchorage. And that, it's a very important drinking water supply for Anchorage. That's roughly 85% of Anchorage's drinking water comes from the Elkutna Lake Basin. The allocation and importance of the hydropower and the drinking water are flipped. I mean, it's a very important drinking water supply, but it uses only about 10% of the Elkutna water. 90% of the water is going to produce power. That represents about 1% of South Central's power demand. So in my mind, the water's not being used to its highest and best purpose.
Mm-hmm. But you mentioned there is some water in there. Is that just water that happens to trickle down?
Right.
So the power companies are taking all the rest of the water?
The power companies combined with the water utility are using 100% of the water. There's no water flowing out of Elkutna Lake on a regular basis. There is a little bit of water downstream. And again, the dam that we just took out is about 8 miles downstream of Elkutna Lake. And most of that 8-mile reach is dry or has very little flow. And there are some springs and seeps and small streams that contribute roughly 10 cubic feet per second of water. And we estimate that that river really needs about 100 cubic feet per second to support fish. It's based on the basin size and the water discharge, it's an equivalent size to the Eagle River. And we have some photos from the 1940s that show how big and powerful that river, Elkutna River, was back in the day before it was dammed. And you have to imagine with a 400-foot deep canyon, there was a pretty powerful river running through there.
Yeah.
And the fish biologists have looked at it and said, well, it looks like it would be outstanding habitat for coho and chinook. And there are still landlocked sockeye in Elkutna Lake. And so that's another kind of brass ring in this, is if we can get this river back healthy, it could be a major asset for Anchorage and South Central Alaska.
Run salmon, yeah.
I mean,
because there's people who fish out there now, but those are stocked right below the, right? Isn't that fishing that takes place right below the power plant from stocked fish?
That's correct. So the water that's discharging from the power plant at the Old Glenn Highway does have a tail race fishery, and those fish have been supplanted, have been stocked. Mm-hmm. There was a hatchery there at the Elkutna tail race.
Sockeye spend a year in fresh water. I mean, that lake could potentially be like a sockeye rearing place.
Well, you look at that lake, it's one of the most beautiful sites in Chugach State Park. It really is a gem. It's a 6-mile-long turquoise blue lake. It looks a lot like Kenai Lake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not saying we're going to have the Kenai River replica here on Elkutna, but we could have a pretty major fishery there someday. Yeah. By all accounts, it was a major salmon producer back in the day. And that's part of the reason why the Elkutna Native Village was located there, because of the tremendous resources in that area, the sheep and the fish and access to other resources. And a big part of this story is what has happened to the Elkutna people over the past 100 years. Mm-hmm. And it's not a story we should all necessarily be
really
proud
sad.
Of.
Yeah.
And, Curtis McQueen, the CEO of Elkutna, talks about the shock and awe that they've been through of highways, railroads, power lines, pipelines, everything coming through them. And, you know, they have done a lot for this community. They have mm-hmm. 7 school sites that they lease for $1 a year. And they haven't asked for much in return. Mm-hmm. To my mind, this is a place where we should be jumping to to fix a wrong that was done a long time ago. This is their river. They never had any say over the damming of this river. And, you know, they have put up with a lot. And we had an interview with Maria Coleman, one of the elders of Aklutna. She said, you know, we grew up, everybody in my family was angry. My parents were angry, mm-hmm. My grandparents were angry, and I didn't know what that was about. And now I'm starting to understand, because some of that anger is dissipating because good things are happening. Like, for instance, this dam is coming down, and I feel like maybe we can move beyond some of that unfortunate history that I grew up under. And that, I mean, that's just tears.
Which was just appropriation, just like, okay, there's a river, it's ours now, we're just taking it.
That's what we did. We didn't really ask the people who were living here.
So what's standing in the way of this? Because it seems like motherhood and apple pie, and as you're saying, you don't need to touch the drinking water, and the power and the electric power is a very small portion of what we're getting. Is it just like institutional inertia? I mean, it seems like politicians would be all over this.
The politicians have been tremendously supportive. I mean, we've had great support across the board from the public and from the Anchorage Assembly. We had a unanimous resolution from the Assembly supporting this. The mayor has been supportive of this. We have a letter from Don Young supporting this. I mean, there hasn't been anybody who hasn't embraced this. The utilities, the power utilities, seem to be slow walking. And we had asked them this fall to release what we call the flushing flow of water into the Aklutna River to help jumpstart the rehabilitation of the system. And they had the capacity to do it, and they have not so far done that. And so we are continuing to keep the pressure on. We're going to be releasing this Patagonia-funded movie this winter, and we are hoping that in due course the utilities will step up and do the right thing. It's an opportunity for them to be heroic and to get a lot of great recognition for, you know, righting an historic mm-hmm. injustice.
And so is that going to cost us in our power bills?
I don't think it will. We've run some numbers. This represents about 1% of South Central's power. If we are allocated something on the order of 10 to 25% of the water, we think the impact on ratepayers is probably going to be negligible or not even apparent on the bill.
Mm, okay. Yeah. So it's sort of a 10 to 20% of 1%.
Yeah, and the utilities obviously like this. This was built by the federal government.
It's paid kind of by free tax, power for them, right?
They like it. It's an easy plant to operate.
And it's carbon-free, that's good.
And you know, I have a different take on that. People point to hydropower as renewable energy, but when you start to impact the ultimate renewable, which in my mind is salmon, mm-hmm. then you can't count this as renewable energy. And, you know, my radical friends over at the Nature Conservancy came out with an article about, you know, how do you measure
radical being an ironic term?
How do you measure the hydropower? And a couple of their first points were that hydropower shouldn't impact salmon runs, it shouldn't alter natural water systems, and it shouldn't change the ability for fish to move up and down the river. And the Aklutna project fails on all three counts. I mean, here we have a river that is completely dry that somehow amazingly supports five species of salmon. If you proposed in this day and age to take all the water out of a salmon river,
like the Kenai or something,
people would come unhinged. And part of the problem here is that we don't remember what we lost. Yeah. We don't know what used to be there. And I think in the future, when this system does come back, and I have a lot of hope that it will indeed come back, and it might take some time, that we will treasure this system. We'll be glad that we did mm-hmm. this, and we'll fight tooth and nail to keep it from happening again.
Yeah.
And you know, a big part of this story here, I think, is that we now know that salmon and dams don't play well together. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the best things that Alaskans have not done on salmon. I mean, we still have the strongest salmon runs in the world mm-hmm. because we haven't screwed up the rivers. We haven't built a lot of dams. Yeah. And here's a case where we did. Hopefully we learned from it. We took the dam down, and we won't make that mistake again.
Well, thanks, Brad. Thank you for the amazing work you've done and also for coming in and telling us about it. And I guess if folks want to weigh in, they can contact their power company. Brad Mickeljohn, Conservation Fund, right? That's the name of it?
That's correct.
All right. Thanks for being with us on Outdoor Explorer. And stay with us. The show will continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, it is kind of supposed to kind of be getting on towards winter now. We haven't been seeing that happening with this very warm fall we've had. Maybe by the time you hear this pre-recorded interview, things will be looking a little bit better. But just because winter's taken a while to get here doesn't mean we shouldn't prepare for it. And for that purpose, I have a guest in here who knows a lot about getting your cross-country skis into perfect condition. Galen Johnston is a tech at AMH, Alaska Mountaineering and Hiking. He's also a Masters and Devos coach at the APU Nordic program, and he's a competitor. And you've done some ski tech for some of the big international races, haven't you, Galen? Mm-hmm.
Mostly just domestic, on the Super Tour with APU and U.S. Nationals races, both spring series and in the middle of winter and whenever else.
Yeah, and Galen's an amazing skier as well, but we're not going to talk about his skiing. We're going to talk about his skis. And we always love to talk about kind of the very best, you know, the Olympians and what are their skis like, and they'll have a fleet of a million skis, and they'll have these techs, and they'll be waxing during the race. But that's, like, not for us, right? Our deal is, like, most of us are recreational skiers, and we'd like our skis to be in decent shape, and it's actually a lot more fun when they are. You know, because your skis go better. But on the other hand, you want to spend more time skiing than in your garage. So there's a balance to be had there. So anyway, Galen, so we're talking here late October. We'll probably be broadcasting this in the middle of November. What are the early season or preseason things to do with a pair of skate skis for, you know, your average cross-country skier in Anchorage? I mean, how do you want to get them in shape for the beginning of the season?
Well, the first thing is to look at what you did over the summer. Most of us are guilty of having neglected our skis over the summer. Some may have slapped a layer of travel wax on, left them in storage. If you did that, awesome, props to you.
I do that maybe 1 year out of five. Yeah,
exactly. My important skis get that treatment. My skis that I'm going to be on first thing in the year don't get that treatment. So getting just a layer, really any wax, doesn't matter. I tend to err towards the warmer end, something from a 20 degree wax or warmer. Be that your Toco Red, your CH7, something super basic.
And these, for those don't know, these are glide waxes. So this is a wax that's going to run the length of your ski and make it slide as fast as possible, which is different from, if you think about classic skiing or kick wax, it's right under your foot and won't run a little sticky. Right now we're just talking glide wax.
Yeah, so if that's another good point. If you have classic skis that have been neglected, getting that kick wax off from last year with a putty knife and wax remover, whatever you need to get that back to a clean base, is going to be your first step. Then just getting any basic wax on your ski, put it on, scrape it off when it's still pretty warm. Will allow some of that dirt, neglected stuff that's stuck to the base, to come back off.
So that's essentially cleaning out the pores. This plastic material, the P-Tex, has got all these little pores in it, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, you know, like having acne on your face. You want those pores to be clean.
Yep. Yeah. We're mostly working with the very surface of that. But that's an analogy that's easy to grasp, is the analogy of a ski base being like a sponge, that it wants to absorb some of that wax. And when we're talking about it in reality, we're talking about the top 10th of an inch or something, a 100th of an inch that actually gets any wax in it.
Yeah.
But the adherence of those wax chemicals to the base requires a relatively clean base in the first place. So
if you've been skiing on this ski like last spring and it was getting pretty cruddy and there was needles and there was dirt and you weren't really taking care of your skis because the racing season was over, and so you got all kinds of gunk stuck in the bottom of the ski.
Yep. Yeah, gunk, or a lot of times when you look at a neglected base, it just looks kind of white, chalky look to it. One good thing, if it looks like that, is to take a metal brush, either steel or bronze, brass brush, and just give it a couple sweeps down the base. And a lot of times that'll pull some of that oxidization out of the base and allow you to actually get a good wax layer on that next one.
So oxidization, that's when you've got your PTEX or your plastic layer that has been exposed too much of the time. In other words, you didn't have enough wax on it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of oxidizes and loses the ability to hold on to that wax.
Yep. Yeah, and you'll see that whether it's just from being left out all summer or if you go and ski a race like the Tour of Anchorage or the USIC, a lot of times by the time you get to the end of the race, you've got that.
There's white, no wax left, yeah.
Yeah, there'd be some on there. Now, bases keep getting better and better, and they're getting better at avoiding that. Mm. But a lot of times a base that gets a little bit too much heat when you're waxing it, if you let the iron sit for a second or you wind up burning your base, then you wind up seeing that oxidization a little bit more quickly.
So when we're talking about this, using an iron and ironing your wax in, you know, some folks won't know how to do that. It's not really not that hard. Mm-hmm. And there's clinics to learn how to do it. And I find it kind of fun and interesting. But if you don't want to do it, you can take it into a shop.
Yep.
And what are you going to tell them when you go?
So when somebody brings me a ski, I'm usually looking for input, and any shop is going to be the same as this, kind of what your average conditions are that you're going to ski in. If you're taking a ski and going up and doing the White Mountains 100, a race up north of Fairbanks, and it's going to be 40 below the whole time, we're going to put a very different wax on than if you're here in town on a warmer winter day. Generally, colder conditions, we're going to err towards a little harder wax that helps harden the base up a little. That will work better in colder conditions.
In the colder conditions, you've got these ice crystals that are going to try to hold you back, so you don't want a lot of sticky wax.
Yeah. You're working more against actual mechanical friction versus dealing with the moisture content of the snow, which you start, same when you go to pack a snowball. If it's zero out, the snowball doesn't pack at all. And it's 30 degrees, you go to pack that snowball, it turns into ice and there's a little bit of water dripping out the bottom. That's the same thing that we're trying to deal with, just those different factors.
So somebody who doesn't have their own wax setup is probably not a super avid skier. I mean, if you're skiing like 4 or 5 days a week, you probably have got a whole wax setup in your
garage.
Hopefully
you are.
Yeah. But if you're skiing like maybe once a week or once every couple of weeks, you might think, well, I'll just take it to the shop and get it waxed. And if you're that person, how long does a wax job last? You know, if you're just, you know, maybe 10 kilometers a week or every couple of weeks, it could last you most of the winter, right?
It could. It really depends how many days you're skiing, how many K's you're covering with that.
I've heard like 50K on a wax job.
Yeah, roughly. That also depends. If we have nice, perfect 20 degree fluffy brand new snow every day, that wax job's going to last a lot longer than if we're in a icy, scrapey, abrasive situation. But yeah, 50K-ish. So I try to wax my skis about once a week. I should do it more, but that's
you're skiing every day.
It's pretty happy. Yeah.
Well, and I think that, I mean, just putting it now, I'm just sticking here still with the person who isn't that into it. Convince that person that actually you do need to get your skis waxed because you're going to enjoy the sport more, then you're going to want to do it more, you're going to get more fit, you're going to become a better skier. And there's all these things that flow out of it. It's not like wax is the end-all and be-all and you should be scared of cross-country skiing because you don't want to wax. It's about like having your skis just slide and have that feeling of flying through the woods, right?
Yep. So I actually had a perfect example for this. My girlfriend's aunt is a recreation skier, and she last year we were out skiing and it was really warm, sticky snow, and she had kick on her skate skis. She's skiing along and they're sticking. All right, give me your skis, let me see these. And they'd never been waxed, and it actually was to the point where the base was starting to degrade, where it didn't have that nice shiny look to the base. It actually looked a little bit furry. And so I took the skis, put a single layer of wax on them, and took them back. And it's the difference between being able to skate up a hill and having the herringbone. If your ski looks like that, and they get that way pretty quickly, it's not fun to ski on.
If you wonder why we like skiing so much, it's because it's super fun, right? There's this stupid article in the New York Times last year during the Olympics where this guy's saying, oh, skiers are stupid, you know?
Yep.
And you're like, okay, why they publish that, I don't know. But I mean, like, yeah, if it's not fun, it's not fun. But we wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't really, really fun. And that's partly about having good skis and having them slide over the snow.
And you think of ice skating as this kind of effortless gliding feel. And skiing is inherently going to be slightly more friction than that because you're dealing with a wider surface. You're not metal on ice. But it shouldn't be that far off of it. In cold snow, different cup of tea. It gets a little squeaky and hard to glide. But in general, we should be able to just ride your skis and have a really nice time, pleasant time.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be having to push that thing along all the time and feel like you have a plank on the bottom of your foot.
So one more waxing question. The different companies have these base waxes or waxes you can put underneath another wax or a race wax, which I guess have molybdenum in them, or they have some kind of metal in them. Would you advise early season putting that down as a binder and then putting another wax on top of it? Or is that more just a sort of a race specific thing?
The moly or graphite waxes, they're super good for just a general. They are a good binder. The one thing that we've found is that they're not as fast in fresh fallen snow. Mm-hmm. So there are times where if we happen to get 2 feet of snow right off the bat and you went out and skied with a ski that has a bunch of that black wax, the either moly or the graphite, it could be a little draggy because of having that wax in. In the long run, not a big issue. So if you are looking for that one wax job of the year, put a layer of that down, then put a layer of ideally a fluorinated wax because that's going to add to that durability.
It's going to last longer and also be slattier and better in wet conditions. But if you are a more serious skier and you're thinking you're going to be waxing your skis every week or every couple of weeks, would you start with the moly or the graphite wax, or are you going to kind of take all your wax off every time you do it so you wouldn't really need to worry about that?
You're going to see both sides of that. Mm-hmm. If you're waxing pretty darn regularly, base it off of, and so I write wax recommendations for the Anchorage Cup races for my groups, and my recommendations, whether or not that black is in there, is wholly dependent on what the recent snow conditions have been. If it just snowed 6 inches and we're going to be on largely new snow, I'll take that layer out, probably put down a harder, like a CH4 or a Toco Blue, something hard, basic, cheap, in place of that layer of black, and then put your race wax over the top of that. For if it's been a week or two since we've had any snow and it's kind of getting into that ground up ice, there's some dirt content to it, then those black waxes help repel that do a good job with that.
Okay, so it's kind of specific to the weather that you're having, conditions you're going to be in, and how fast you need to go. Like if you're just working out at Kincaid, you probably don't need the pure fluoro or this expensive
stuff.
And
it's even going to depend what trails you're skiing. Because if you're skiing the Kincaid trails, only the ski-only trails, and you're staying away from Leakish where you get some of that blown-in dirt, if you're down in the hollows and the lake loop, that snow stays super clean for a long time. As soon as you get onto the multi-use trails or onto coastal trail, anywhere where there's some kind of dust, dirt spinning up in the air, dog paws, people walking, then all of a sudden the day after it snows, you have more of that dirt content and makes your waxing choice a little different. Now you put the same wax on every day. Are you going to notice it? You might. Mm-hmm. It's possible, but it's not a life or death situation on that one.
Well, the thing
just
about
wax your skis.
Yeah, you could be sucked down into this a long way. You know, this is one of those things where the gearheads and the nerds will spend hours on it. You know, and if you like that, awesome. It's another fun aspect of the sport. If you don't, you don't have to. It's like you can use a computer without knowing everything about the inside of the computer.
Yep,
it's the same deal. So let's talk about that P-Tex, and before the first layer of wax goes on, if you want high performing skis, you need to have them ground and get the very top layer off, right? Because that top layer is going to degrade over time and get some kind of texture into the ski. Talk a little bit about that and what choices you make there, and sort of like when you need to do that.
Okay, so the grind of a base is when you look at your ski, when it's brand new, it has a series of kind of microstructures on the base. It's not completely flat, completely smooth. And those are designed to kind of interact. That's what's actually interacting with the snow crystals as you glide over the snow. For colder snow, for colder skis, we tend to err towards a finer structure. Again, we're dealing with that mechanical friction. The finer the structure, the less we have to actually catch in those aggressive cold mm-hmm. crystals.
So if you're like a ski, you know, competing at the national or international level, you're going to have a series of skis
yep.
ground to different structures.
Yep. Yeah. And different grinds, different mm-hmm. flexes. There's all sorts mm-hmm. of different
right.
variables there. At a base sense, when what I try to encourage people to get towards is having two pairs of skis, both for skate and for classic, ideally, or whichever, if you're mm-hmm. only a skater, get two pairs of skis.
So basically four pairs of skis
for
anybody who's halfway serious.
Yep. Yeah. And go towards having a cold ski and a warm ski. Do you need that to enjoy the sport? No. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, if you have a ski has a really aggressive grind on it, and some of the, especially kind of the mid or lower range skis that you'll see come with a pretty aggressive grind on them. If you go to ski that ski when it's below 10, 5 degrees, it's going to feel really catchy and like you're really having to push the ski. And in some cases, just putting a finer grind on that ski, something we can do at AMH, different shops around mm-hmm. town do that as well. Having that finer grind, even on a warmer ski, can help that.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, having a ski that's specifically designed for cold snow and a ski that's designed for
right.
warm snow is going to make that enjoyment right. factor creep up.
And then when they do the grind, they're going to put a layer of wax on and bake it in so that you get mm-hmm. a really nice a surface for your future waxing.
Yep. Yeah. So when we grind, it takes off. We usually do a couple passes depending on how aggressive the damage of the base is. And that can be damage from rocks, pebbles that you mm-hmm. skied over, or just over time. You'll see sometimes when that initially the structure of the base is pretty sharp. And over time, as it gets waxed and skis,
yeah.
it gets really rounded out and you can't see much of the structure at all. And at that point, when you start getting into warmer snow, it gets really sticky, suctiony mm-hmm. feel, which a grind can really help alleviate.
Yeah.
So
it's a good time to do it before the snow comes, because you got to drop the ski off and you won't have it for a little while, right?
Yep.
And so get it squared away and ready to go.
Yep. Right now we're grinding about once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And through the summer we do grind as well, but it's usually batch orders where we wait until we have 10 or so, 5-10 skis mm-hmm. built up, and sometimes that's a month out before we have enough skis
yeah.
to put through.
I think a lot of people have a nice pair of skis, and then they will have a pair of rock skis, which are
yep.
their old skis that have been beat up. Do you do anything with your rock skis, or do you say like they're already so thrashed, like I'm not going to worry about like grinding them or prepping them or anything?
So it depends how bad they get, because
mm-hmm.
they can get to the point where they're nearly unskiable and they're going to make that first ski of the year really unpleasant, even
yeah.
though you're really excited about
so just
being
get rid
first
of them.
Year.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. One thing you can play with, and what
I do
to mine.
People skiing on skis, like it's almost a point of pride. Like I'm skiing on a ski that's totally
yep.
thrashed garbage. Like,
yep.
okay, good for you.
yep. A lot of times with those rock skis, you're skiing in conditions where you get P-Tex that's just curled off the side of
right.
the base. And there's a lot of obvious friction happening there. So
yeah.
going through, and either one thing I'll do a lot at AMH and on my own skis is taking either a razor blade or a
mm-hmm.
metal scraper and actually
cutting
dulling
off.
Some of
yeah.
that stuff out.
Yep.
So there's not actually things hanging into the snow
right.
and dragging
And what's
along.
The point of like doing a lot of wax or work on something that's already that
yeah.
bad? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing to me how much a layer of wax can help a ski like
mm.
that, where it'll look so thrashed. And you go through and you trim off a couple little hangers on and
mm-hmm.
just be careful not to go too far into the base with that. Kind of trim them wherever the edge is and
mm-hmm.
go through that, maybe dull out a few things with a steel scraper and then stick a layer of wax on there, and all of a sudden it looks like, oh wow, a lot of those scrapes kind of disappeared on
yeah.
me. And things just with the heat, the
uh-huh.
P-Tex is a really malleable substance, and a lot of stuff, if it gets hit by a dull rock or something, if you heat it, a lot of that stuff will start to pop back out, and it won't look quite as egregious as it did to start with.
Right, right.
It's not quite time to throw them in the dumpster. They might have another season or two.
All right. Well, thanks, Galen. It's always fun to talk. Galen has been my coach in the master's program at APU, which I would recommend to anyone. It's just a really fun way to improve your skiing ability. He also coaches the Devos, who are the kids, right? What ages?
6th through 8th grade. So my youngest is 10, and my oldest in the master's program right now is 87. So
wow.
If you fit somewhere in that spectrum, I'm happy to coach you.
Yeah, and he's also at tech at AMH, and drop your skis off. He might be down there taking care of them. All right, well, thanks for coming in, and let's pray for snow.
Yeah, thank you much. Do your snow dances.
All right, stay with us. Outdoor Explorer will continue. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We've talked at various times about keeping girls active as they go through middle school and leave elementary school and the challenges of that. As a dad, I went through that trying to keep my girls interested in skiing and interested in doing outdoor activities and sports as they moved into their high school years. In our country, that's kind of a cultural thing, right? That's something about how girls see themselves and how they stay involved. But in other countries where they have fewer resources and fewer privileges than we do, it's actually a practical thing. And that's what we're going to talk about in this next segment. I have two guests in the studio from two different organizations, one focusing on sports bras for girls in another country where they wouldn't have access to them, which makes it possible to continue doing sports. And the other, who is involved with a group which is international and works on feminine products and dealing with menstruation issues so that girls can stay active and also stay active in many other parts of life. And Connie Quinley approached me originally. I think I just got an email from you, Connie, because you were raising money for your project, which is called Go Guatemala Girls. And it's just you at this point, right?
At this point it is,
yeah.
Yep.
And V. Anderson is here representing Days for Girls, which is a big, big organization with a lot of chapters and is working on this project. And thanks for being here, V.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, Connie, tell me how you got interested in this topic, which coming in Anchorage, Alaska, is not necessarily the very first thing that we think about.
True. I was part of a 2015 team of about 12 people who went to Guatemala, and it was a multifaceted team doing carpentry and medical care. And one angle of it was providing Days for Girls kits to deal with menstruation to a group of underserved girls and their mothers in Jalapa, Guatemala. And at some point, I thought it would be great to pair sports bras with those kits. The kits would help the girls stay in school and participate in sports during their periods, which they would otherwise not be able to do. And I thought, well, the sports bras would also help them as they're developing breasts to continue to be able to participate in sports, which I personally think is just critical to happiness and development.
Right. And that's something that they would not have heard of or wouldn't have the money to buy? Or what's the situation in that in Guatemala that would make this necessary?
Guatemala has some affluent areas, but primarily is a fairly poor country, and the girls we're targeting in Jalapa would not have access to sports bras. Certainly would have heard of them and know what goes on, but wouldn't have access to sports bras.
Yeah, yeah. So as a dude who doesn't have to worry about this, I mean, if you've got large breasts and you don't have a way to hold them in place, you're kind of can't run, can't do a lot of things.
That's
right?
It. And I think large breasts are no. Tissue is tissue, and if it bounces around, it's going to hurt, and it's also going to tear. And there's also the factor of puberty just being hard. And you kind of think everybody's looking at you, especially boys, if you're running around. And you don't want to be looked at for those reasons. Yeah. So I think this is kind of an empowering thing for the girls to not feel they're being looked at as they run and play and do things that girls should be able to do.
So, do you have daughters, Connie?
I do.
Okay.
Daughter Elizabeth, who's been very active in the Nordic ski community. And we have been fortunate in this community that she has been supported by the community and that we have enough money to provide her with what she needs, et cetera. But it isn't the case for most girls.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I often feel like my own kids are so lucky coming up in this community with really great schools and great friends and great, you know, positive, healthy activities. And so then when they're gone, you kind of do think, wow, I'd like to have that for other kids too, right?
Right, yeah. And I think you see the joy that it brings to the child.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to find out more about how you're going about your project, but I also want to bring V in on this conversation. The Days for Girls has been around for quite a while. And just sort of explain to us like what the organization is and what you do.
Well, Days for Girls just celebrated its 10th birthday in October. And they have been around since the founder and CEO established it back in 2008. She went to Kenya and through that traveling discovered a significant need in the developing countries to provide, educate, and to address the issues associated with young women entering their reproductive years. So Days for Girls internationally has reached over 1 million girls in that 10-year period in more than 120, I think it's 124 countries. And they have provided not only menstrual kits for young women and for older women as well, but they have created an amazing venue for education about menstrual health, women's health issues, reproductive issues, and some very sensitive cultural subjects that often don't get talked about because it's a taboo in that culture.
Mm-hmm. As it used to be in ours a generation ago.
That is correct.
Yeah, yeah. So help us understand how sort of a menstruation works culturally in some of these countries that are more traditional than our country and that are gripped in a kind of poverty that we don't really see here. How does menstruation become a handicap for a girl to continue to be involved in outdoor activities or sports or school or any of those things?
Well, I can speak from my experience from 3 mission trips in Guatemala and also from the information that's available at the Days for Girls website, which is daysforgirls.org, if you want to learn more about the organization. In the case of Guatemala, we distribute to girls from the age 10 up through 20, about. Oftentimes, these young women drop out of school because maybe a girl will have 2 outfits for everything in her life. Mm. And if it becomes soiled, then she won't go outside. She won't go to school. She won't go out into culture. The pairing with the sports bras is really perfect because the other thing that young Guatemalan girls don't have an opportunity to do is become physically active through school sports. If they're dropping out of school, then oftentimes their opportunity to become physically active and to understand the alliance with women's health issues isn't there. So it makes for a good pairing to educate these young women, and not only young women, but their moms, their aunts, their grandmothers, who realize that the young women in life can be much more productive in culture and in her own life if she has opportunities to stay out and active.
Yeah, So it sounds like it's not only providing supplies and the kits, but it's that maybe the education is even the more important part about it.
I think that that is the most important thing that Days for Girls does. And I have to commend the international organization because they've taken multicultural venues and provided guidelines on appropriate education for women's health issues and women's life issues, so that when you distribute and you promote this program, it's as much of an educational program as it is a life-changing and impacting program mm-hmm. for the girls that receive the kits.
And you want to be culturally sensitive and welcome in that community and have them happy you were there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so when there is a distribution, we always use people in the community that the girls are familiar with. It's a safe and secure environment for them to talk about some of these sensitive issues.
Mm-hmm. Connie, in your sports bra project, how is this working? I know this is just got off the ground because I saw the email that you sent out looking for what donations, and like you'd found sports bras for $5 a piece, which mm-hmm. I thought, that's amazing. I would argue to guess like 10 times that amount,
yeah,
right?
Well, for some.
Yeah. And so you're getting this thing off the ground, and you were even a little hesitant to come in because you're thinking maybe this is too new. But what are you actually doing? How are you pulling it off, and how can people help?
I have begun a GoFundMe site called Go Guatemala Girls. And after checking around in various stores and online, found that I could get basic sports bras in the right sizes for about $5 per. And that's with maybe my coupon and mm-hmm. Hunting around. And I was in Albuquerque recently and went to the Walmart there to check out their prices mm-hmm. and picked up a bunch of sports bras there. So I think $5 is is not only doable for buying the bra, but is a doable amount of money for people mm-hmm. to donate. And I want anybody who feels moved to donate to be able to. Mm-hmm. And I think $5 is pretty
reasonable.
Sure. Reasonable.
Well, I mean, that would be the minimum. I mean, if you want to donate, you could give lots of sports bras.
Well, you certainly could.
Yeah. What is your goal? I mean, do you have a sense of how you're going to, you know, you're going to go down there with an X number of sports bras? How many are needed? You know, I mean, this could be big, right?
That would be fun. Right now, the goal is about 250 to 300 sports bras, and uh-huh. those would go down with the team members who will be traveling in July of 2019. I won't be going on that trip. And my initial idea was that those bras, along with education about breast development, would be supplied with the Days for Girls kits. It's possible that those will be supplied separately. We don't know yet.
Right. You haven't actually merged with the other group, but you're just inspired by the other group and you're
Correct.
Doing something separate on
right.
your own.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So education, as we've talked about, is a big part of it. And I actually found out that there isn't a whole lot of research that's been mm-hmm. done on the link between girls' activities and sports bras. There's in Portsmouth, UK, there have been significant studies done on it, but I haven't found a whole lot mm-hmm. otherwise.
It's kind of obvious, though.
It seems to be, yeah. Yeah, it does. So that's how that began, just an idea that I had, and GoFundMe is just amazingly easy to use.
And we'll put a link to Connie's GoFundMe page on outdoorexplorer.org, so you can go right through it and if you have any trouble finding it. Do you have further ambitions for this idea, or you're just sort of trying it out and see what happens this first round?
Just trying it out.
Yeah, I mean, you could be on the have a tiger by the tail here, because this sounds like something everybody would want to support. I mean, who wouldn't want to support it, right?
And the word support is obviously a good tie-in there. Right.
There you go. Yeah.
Support the supports.
Well, and I think just the education part of it, you know, mm-hmm. realizing how lucky we are to mm-hmm. have what we have in this country, this area.
Absolutely.
And helping others understand that as well.
So, V, how can folks get involved with Days for Girls and contribute? And I'm sure there are different levels of involvement. Somebody could just make a donation, or they could actually become a member and be part of what you're doing, right?
Absolutely. I have a team co-leader. Her name is Mary Werner, and we have actually established a chapter for Days for Girls here in South Anchorage. That email, if you want to get involved on the local level, is sanchoragee@daysforgirls.org.
And we will get that on our website at outdoorexplorer.org, so if people can find it, or and also find your Facebook page.
And additionally, yes, we do have a Facebook page, and that's Days for Girls South Anchorage Chapter.
Okay.
So that's a way to access information.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have, as a chapter, we've developed several standing appointments every month where people can get involved, and we'll be publishing that on the Facebook page. And then we have special events that are geared toward producing kits for distribution, for specific distributions. And our most successful to date was one in June of this year, where we produced 100 kits to be distributed to girls in Uganda. And then we later followed up with an additional 50 kits. So when you get many, many women together from many, many different service organizations in the community, you can really make an impact and you can really get a lot done.
That's neat and inspiring, and sounds like something that's really rewarding to be part of.
It is, and I would have to emphasize the fact that when women, mostly women, we have some men involved, but when women get together and they want to do something that's going to impact other women's lives, this for me is a perfect project, because you don't have to sew. There are many, many things that you can do to contribute to this effort. And if you come to one of the big events, you'll see people cutting and sewing and organizing kits. You get a sense that this is a completely from the heart, anonymous contribution to help some woman in another country with no glory associated
with
it.
Nothing expected in return.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And that makes it very pure. Yeah.
Yes, and it's a very, very gratifying feeling to be involved with something like that.
It's wonderful. Well, thank you both for coming in, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to want to get involved. So what you'll do is go to outdoorexplorer.org, click on today's show, and then you'll find the links to Connie and V's organizations, and you can follow up and donate and have all those good feelings inside. Thank you so much, Connie Quinley. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Connie's with Go Guatemala Girls. She is Go Guatemala Girls. She created it.
I'm going.
And V. Anderson, Days for Girls, the Anchorage chapter. Thanks for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure, and just it's been great to be a part of this. And I have to give Connie lots of kudos, because she's the bomb.
She's doing something new. That's really cool. Well, that's all for today's show. I want to thank our first guest today, Brad Micklejohn from the Conservation Fund, who's done all that work on the Kluteno River, and Galen Johnston from Alaska Mountaineering and Hiking, and also from APU. Galen talked to us about ski prep. Our producer for Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.